Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's always a delight to be able to talk with my friend Matt Brodsky, a distinguished Middle East expert and voluble contributor to the public policy debate on what's going on there and what it means for us, notably in places like National Review, the Weekly Standard, and The Federalist. We're always pleased to have him with us. And Matt, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Great to be with you.
I had an opportunity to be at the Jewish Institute for the National Security of America, JINSA, dinner last night, where the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was among those honored. He said some interesting things, new to me, I have to say, Matt, and perhaps to our listeners as well. And I wanted to just talk through with you what's currently going on vis-a-vis a kind of retooling of American policy towards the disaster in Syria. Specifically, Secretary Pompeo talked about the fact that the United States was not going to put, I think he said, a single dollar into the immense reconstruction aid program for Syria as long as the Iranians were in place there. Tell us what's going on in that regard and otherwise.
First of all, we've seen a definite focus now from the administration on how to work out this vexing problem of getting to a Syrian endgame. A lot of that has to do with the appointment of Syrian envoys from Ambassador James Jeffrey and Joel Rayburn moving over from the National Security Council over to the State Department. And what they've done is created an effort that focuses on first of all, uniform messaging, the whole administration, all parts of it saying that it's not just about preventing the use of chemical weapons, it's preventing any slaughter at all would be seen as a dramatic escalation. That's one part. Another part is the behind the scenes diplomacy that we've seen going on, which has been a very large concentration, including with Turkey, that the U.S. was able to get a deal there, but also by creating what is called the Syria Small Group that has come into existence. And this consists of Middle Eastern allies and some European states. And what it has is a list of principles that they've agreed to in general, which says that there can't be any reconstruction funding that goes into areas held by the regime, because if it's held by the regime, it's held by Iran and Russia. And that any type of reconstruction must be tied to a credible and unalterable political process, which is the Geneva process that has already been led by the UN, but was never empowered or invigorated by the previous administration. And of course, there's also the military dimension, where the U.S. has been beefing up its presence in the northeast of Syria in response to Russian threats. Now, this is important with the Syria small group as far as reconstruction, because we know that Russia's plan and Iran's plan since the July 16th Helsinki summit is to try to pretend that the war is over, to try to gain as much funding as possible. And this is standing in its way.
Yeah. Fascinating. Let me turn to another subject that's in your wheelhouse, Matt. In neighboring Turkey, there has been an incident, it appears, involving a journalist by the name of Jamal Khashoggi, who contributed to the Washington Post, Saudi journalist and critic of the regime. CNN is reporting today that, according to a U.S. official who obviously has breached all kinds of security considerations, has reported that American intelligence had intercepts of Saudi officials discussing a plan according to CNN, to lure this journalist back to Saudi Arabia. They got him into the consulate, the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Not quite clear what happened after that. What can you tell us about this saga and what it might involve for Turkish-Saudi relations and perhaps our own with both countries?
Right. Well, the problem with this episode is, of course, we have been up until now primarily relying on the words of Saudi Arabia, who has had frankly, they've had it in for him, for Khashoggi, for a long time, given what he's been writing and his ties that are believed to the Muslim Brotherhood. And at the same time, the other party is, of course, Turkey, who is very much against Saudi Arabia because they, of course, are supporting the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the region and has a record of locking up more journalists than any other country in the world. So it's hard to take the word of one over the other at the moment, though it does seem to be, if it were to be carried out by Saudi Arabia, that being his assassination or any sort of physical harm, it would seem to be a rather brazen act that would be very, very difficult to hide, especially given the images we've seen of him going into the embassy, or even down to the latest reporting I've seen where it shows that he had been on his WhatsApp phone application prior to going in, and that since that moment, any of the messages he received, he has not looked at, which is odd if he were to be in fine health hiding some other place. So it's a mess to untangle, and it's going to require deft diplomacy on our part as far as how we're going to work around and through this issue.
Yeah. It raises, I guess, just in closing, Matt Brodsky, a larger question. There's been a lot of people, including, I think it's fair to say, the president and people around him, investing in Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. There are reports that this plot to shall we say, neutralize Khashoggi in one form or another, was in fact ordered by the Crown Prince. I don't know if you can speak to that or not, but either way, what might the implications be for the hope that this man is not only a great reformer internally, but also a reliable partner for the United States in external matters as well?
Well, how the reform platform goes in the Saudi Arabian 2030 plan, it's still in its infancy. And the U.S. has seen many good, positive steps taken by MBS. However, you know, this is something that the United States needs to stand by a free press in countries. It's very important. And I think it would definitely cause a disruption in our relationship. Yet I still think that given the overall issues that we have to deal with in the region, specifically Iran, and the importance of Saudi Arabia setting a reforming example going forward for the rest of the Arab Middle East, it's important that we still work with them, but also show quite resolutely that this type of behavior is simply not going to be tolerated.
Matt, we have to leave that at that for the moment. I appreciate so much your time and your expertise. I look forward to your further reporting on these matters, and I hope we'll have a chance to visit with you again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Hans von Spakovsky. I've decided, Hans, that your name being one of those that you got to work at, like Victor Davis Hanson, we're just going to reduce this to your acronym. HVS is in the house virtually, I'm so pleased to say. HVS, Hans von Spakovsky, of course, is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese III, Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. He has a distinguished record in government, having worked at the Justice Department as the counsel for the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Hans, always good to have you with us. It's so much to talk about. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. Yeah, there's been a lot going on in Washington, D.C.
There has, and elsewhere, too. Let's talk about a couple of aspects of it. You have, of course, followed closely the trials and tribulations and ultimately the installation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Your thoughts on what he went through in terms of a honing fire and what it might mean for his time on the Supreme Court of the United States?
Well, I don't think it's going to affect his time on the Supreme Court, but I do have to say I think it's one of the most shameful episodes in the entire history of the United States Senate. This is probably, look, Kavanaugh is probably one of the most qualified individuals to ever be nominated to the Supreme Court. And when the progressive left, Democratic senators, couldn't shake him on the law, on his professional credentials, false charges were brought against him, claiming, as you know, sexual assault and other things. And, you know, even the FBI confirmed in their final investigation that there was no evidence whatsoever. And there were so many inconsistencies and holes in the stories being brought by the accusers. But that, quite frankly, the entire thing looks like a put-up job. But is it going to affect his time on the court? No, although I do think, because the left is so afraid of the kind of decisions that are going to come out of the court, that they will try to use that to delegitimize the Supreme Court and any decisions that they don't agree with.
Yeah. Well, let's hope there are going to be a lot of them coming out of this new alignment. Let me ask you about another topic that I know, again, you're following closely, Hans, and that is what is going on inside the FBI? There's a new addition to the cast of characters that have come, it seems to me, to personify the corruption of the Bureau's leadership in recent years, in addition to the Bob Mueller and James Comey and Andrew McCabe and Peter Strzok and Lisa Pages over there. There's a fellow by the name of James Baker, who was its general counsel until fairly recently. Tell us what we've learned about his role and what it does to further reinforce real concerns about what's happened to an important instrument of our law enforcement community.
Well, you know, he's been testifying before the Congress, the investigating committees, and it appears that he has said that there were meetings. Remember, the whole problem with this entire investigation, Russia collusion investigation, is the idea that the FBI may have relied only on the Steele dossier, and they may not have informed the FISA court that this was, in fact, political opposition research. Well, now, according to Baker, they weren't just relying on the Steele dossier, which they supposedly got from this former MI6 agent, but there were meetings with a lawyer from Perkins Coie. Perkins Coie is the big Democratic law firm in Washington, D.C. that was the general counsel for the Clinton campaign. So it appears as if the Clinton campaign, through its lawyers, was directly feeding opposition research to the FBI, and that's what pushed them to basically open up the investigation, which is, frankly, unbelievable.
Well, it's political warfare. Let's call it what it is. The government in the service of the Democratic Party and its candidate. This brings us to Rod Rosenstein, who, of course, is the deputy attorney general and who has, in the wake of the recusal of the attorney general on matters involving the campaign, overseen, well, in the first instance, commissioned one of those FBI characters, Bob Mueller, to become a special counsel to investigate this alleged illusory, it seems, proposition that Donald Trump and his campaign colluded with the Russians. But Rod Rosenstein seems to be increasingly finding himself the subject of not only great criticism, but investigation as well. Tell us about that.
Well, there's a there's a problem with the fact that, remember, Congress is investigating whether there was a legitimate basis for the FBI and DOJ applying to the FISA court to get a warrant authorizing secret electronic surveillance of the Trump campaign. And it, you know, and we've known now for quite some time that Rosenstein actually signed and approved the renewal of that application. So he's had a conflict of interest from the very beginning over this entire case. Nothing's ever been done by that. The IG is looking into it. Now, you know, there's all this controversy over the claims that he said, well, should he wear a wire when he goes in to talk to the president? He says, well, he was just joking. James Baker claims that he didn't think he was joking, but we don't really know the answer to that.
Yeah. This is no joke, as they say. Well, let's hope that the Congress has success in getting their hands on this fellow. But, of course, that's one of the things that will be hanging in the balance, isn't it, with this coming election. This brings me to a question that I'd like to put to you, Hans von Spakovsky, in light of your experience with and expertise and writing on the subject of voting integrity. Namely, how's it looking for this election, Hans? I've been hearing a lot about early voting, maybe even that the vote will be over long before Election Day as a result of early voting. Is that a problem from a voting integrity perspective?
Yeah, I can't say I don't like early voting. That's a phenomenon that only started in the 1980s. Now about two-thirds of the states have it, and the number of people voting early has been going up every election. And this election, as many as 30-40% of people across the country may have voted by Election Day. So, yeah, the elections could be decided prior to Election Day because of that. Early voting is problematical. I think it makes it easier for different kinds of fraud to occur. And, you know, the biggest thing about it that people should understand is this has been pushed by social scientists and others saying, well, this will help turnout. It'll help get people out. All these people can't make it to the their polling place on Election Day. There have now been a number of studies done that all seem to agree that, in fact, early voting hurts turnout. It doesn't help turnout. It actually hurts turnout. It's kind of counterintuitive, but that's what the studies show.
Interesting. And this reminds me of the argument that IDs are an impediment to voting as well and therefore mustn't be utilized. What's the status of that, Hans? How many states do require voter ID, and is that likely to be more in the future, and should it be?
More than a dozen states now require a government-issued photo ID. About two-thirds of the states require something, you know, a lot less than that.
A utility bill or something like that, right?
Right, exactly. Right. A court just upheld North Dakota's voter ID law. So very slowly states are putting these in. But that's never going to happen, unfortunately, in the very blue states like New York and California, where anybody can walk into a polling place and vote, no questions asked, no
and
ID,
do.
Asked for.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, Hans, I wanted just to finish with one last thing. I did my commentary today on a bit of a controversy that's been stirred up by some remarks of President Trump about George Soros and a tweet that Rudy Giuliani retweeted to the effect that George Soros, this philanthropist, financial mega billionaire, has, been depicted as the Antichrist. You followed his career and his machinations and his philanthropy for years, I know. Where do you come down on the question?
Well, I do think he's dangerous. For example, he is very much against election integrity. He and his organizations have been funding all of the groups that have been fighting and litigating against putting in common sense election integrity reforms, like requiring an ID when you go vote, requiring you to provide proof of citizenship when you register. It has been his money that has been helping to fight these kind of reforms all over the country. And what does that tell you? That he doesn't want elections in this country to have the kind of security and integrity that's needed. That to me is
just one example. We could go into a million of them and probably need to. Indeed, we will be in the days ahead. Azra Nomani also had a good piece in the Wall Street Journal about his involvement in the disruptive and really horrifically upsetting behavior of people in connection with the Kavanaugh nomination. So he's up to no good across a very broad front. We'll talk with you again soon, my friend. Thank you. HVS, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. Come back to us again very soon, if you would, Hans. In the meantime, all the best. Right. Next up, the great Elaine Donnelly joins us from the Center for Military Readiness on the latest in the war on the culture of the United States military and what it might mean.
Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is truly an honor as well as a great delight to say we are joined by one of my most admired colleagues. Her name is Elaine Donnelly. She is the founder and president of an extraordinarily important organization. If you care about our national security, few people are doing more, certainly per capita, than Elaine Donnelly and the Center for Military Readiness to help support our military personnel with respect to a front on which they are beleaguered and in great need of help, namely in terms of the culture of the military. The Center for Military Readiness is what I think is at the pointy end of the spear, trying to help those men and women in uniform. Elaine Donnelly is its leader. She is a great resource and always a wonderful and welcome guest. Elaine, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you for all those kind words, Frank. I'm privileged to deal with these issues in the field of public policy. We care about our men and women who serve, and we don't want them harmed by flawed personnel policies that make their life more difficult and more dangerous.
Well, and that's precisely, of course, what they've been subjected to, as you've done more than anybody, really, to chronicle, specifically during the Obama years. But now, for reasons we'll be discussing, in continuing to some degree, at least, under a very different administration, an administration that does care about them and that is trying to do something about the problem. But let's talk a little bit about manifestations of the assault on the culture of the military that took place, particularly during the Obama years.
Well, there's a lot of work for this administration to do to undo the damage. And the good news is that the administration is taking serious, measured steps to, first of all, evaluate the damage, to figure out a better way to reassert sound priorities, what the Secretary of Defense keeps calling mission readiness and combat lethality. So if that is your primary objective, they were not. Under Obama, diversity, gender diversity metrics, 25% across the board, 10% for the Marine Corps. These goals were imposed regardless of the impact on readiness and morale and everything else, which means quotas. If you have gender diversity quotas, then you have to adjust your standards. You have to pretend that nothing has changed. You have to remove the more demanding training exercises, which harms the men. They don't get as good training as they otherwise would. And it's unfair to women, too, because injury rates skyrocket among the female population. So, the tide is starting to turn. There's a new task force that the Secretary of Defense established looking at the infantry and direct combat units, direct ground combat units in the Army and the Marine Corps to strengthen their mission readiness and combat lethality. In the course of conducting this review, I think the gender diversity quotas are going to be questioned. I think we're going to be seeing perhaps a fresh look at the issue of sexual assaults in the military, which became relevant during the Kavanaugh trauma that we just went through recently. We're going to see also the legal fight is going on in court on the issue of transgenders in the military, because the president's new policy is being challenged in court. Four federal district judges have said this president doesn't have the right to change his predecessor's policies, which is outrageous and an overextension of their power.
Elaine, I want to come back to the courts in a minute, but just to stay with the condition of the military and what's being done to try to remedy it, talk a little bit about the reporting about, or over-reporting, it seems, about sexual assault accusations in the United States military at the moment as a byproduct, apparently, of much of this social engineering and, diversification that was taking place under the previous administration.
This is part of the cost of having a gender-mixed military. The armed forces have had a problem with sexual assaults for many years. The answer is usually said, well, let's put women in combat units and that'll take care of it. Never does. The trend line rates of actual assaults continues to go up every year. But there's also another trend line that was relevant with regard to the Kavanaugh nomination. That is the number of accusations that are unfounded, that are looked at and deemed unsubstantiated. It turns out that the official numbers from the Department of Defense show that the percentage on average is 18% going back to 2009 and as high as 26% in fiscal year 2016, slightly down to 23% last year. That's an awful lot of false accusations. So the Department of Defense keeps saying, oh, it's a good thing more women are reporting incidents of sexual assault. And of course, we want justice for those anyone who is assaulted in the military or anywhere. But we want justice for the accused as well. When the trend line shows that false accusations are escalating at a very steep rate, that is another problem that the military hasn't really addressed yet.
Elaine, you've also reported on some significant changes that appear to be underway within the Army, trying to reverse some of this social engineering of the past. Talk a little bit about that.
It starts with the new task force, the Ground Combat Task Force that Secretary Mattis has established. They're visiting the bases in both the Army and the Marine Corps, the previously all-male units, and looking at ways to improve mission readiness. Well, one of the things they're going to have to look at we know non-deployability is an issue, too, that they are addressing. The Secretary of Defense is saying readiness first, social engineering second. Everything will be reevaluated, and this is really a good thing. You can't solve a problem unless you know what the problem is. So the first thing we're going to see new leadership, the chiefs of staff, the Army, the new commandant of the Marine Corps. We don't know who it is yet, but I think we're going to see new leaders who take an entirely different approach to all of these issues. So I'm very optimistic.
What you have done so importantly, Elaine, it seems to me, is not only to challenge what's going on when it is so transparently contrary to military readiness, but also to help document the costs to the military of the amount of time and energy expended on everything from paperwork to training, sensitivity training, to these various proceedings in which, somebody's being investigated or somebody's career is being ruined because they weren't, conforming to the social engineering program. And it's such an important public service. So thank you. Part of how we can tell your effectiveness is the fact that you are being subjected, you personally, your organization, the Center for Military Readiness, to lawfare And you've talked a little bit about some of this this court business and what's being done to the president's prerogatives as commander-in-chief and the sensible good order and discipline he's trying to restore. But tell us about what the courts are being used to do to, well, it seems to me, at the minimum, suppress the work of the Center for Military Readiness.
Well, it's part of a campaign to stop the president from changing the Obama policies. So far, there have been legal victories for federal district judges, the lowest level of federal judge. They have issued preliminary injunctions ordering the president to restore Obama's policies regarding transgenders in the military and persons who suffer from gender dysphoria. This is a psychological condition. It requires sound medical treatment and compassion, but it does affect deployability, and the Secretary of Defense did a full study, and they documented the costs in terms of time and money in accommodating people who have this psychological condition. But the courts are saying, oh no, the president has animus against transgenders in the military, therefore his policies are not worthy of deference by the courts. Now, that theory I just expressed to you is being expressed in court documents, as ludicrous as it is. It requires overlooking the full study, overlooking all the data, and focusing on President Trump's tweets from July 2017, which they say that was the policy, that's all we're going to look at. And they've extended this theory, this conspiracy theory, to say, well, outside groups also must have played a role in persuading the president to act upon animus, not concern about national defense. Enter the subpoenas against the Center for Military Readiness, and we're not alone. Heritage Foundation, Family Research Council, other groups and individuals, we're supposed to turn over to these LGBT activist groups emails on this subject with Pentagon and White House officials going back to the first day of the president's campaign to run for president from 2015. It would cost thousands of dollars to search our emails, to produce this information that they really are not entitled to at all, just to prove a theory about this, the state of mind of President Trump. Now, it really is a ludicrous theory, but as you know, anyone can go into court and hassle you with subpoenas or lawsuits. We're not being sued, but the subpoena does have to be fought in court. So there's going to be a hearing on October 23rd, federal court. I have to defend my First Amendment right to petition the government, to write about the issues as we do. We have found a very good legal representation, fortunately, Thomas More Law Center, Professor William Woodruff. These people are supporting CMR in this effort, but it's, I have to tell you, it's been very difficult for us.
I'm sure it has.
And heavy burden already.
It is a heavy burden, and again, to the extent that it requires you to take your eye off the ball, that's a really bad thing for our men and women in uniform, as I say, and for our country. Elaine, we have to let it go at that. I do want to just close by saying, folks, if you appreciate what CMR does, I encourage you to go to cmrlink.org and contribute to help Elaine fight this legal battle, as well as to do the important work to help get our military back to the fighting trim that it needs to be at. Elaine, again, thank you for your time today and for the great work you do. Come back to us again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with Gordon Chang, one of the country's great authorities on matters involving Asia and our interests there. Gordon is, of course, the author of two terrific books. One, The Coming Collapse of China. The other, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. He is a columnist for The Daily Beast and a very active contributor through Fox News and other platforms to the public policy debate. We're always grateful that he takes some time to contribute to it through our platform. Gordon, welcome back. Good to have you.
No, well, thank you, Frank, and I'm always so grateful to be on your platform, so thank you.
Thank you, sir. Let me ask you, Gordon, we often talk about China. A curious thing came to light. I didn't know that the head of the international law enforcement mechanism known as Interpol was a Chinese national, and he is evidently gone missing during a recent trip to China. What's going on here? How is it that the Chinese are in charge of Interpol? And what's happened to this fellow, as best we can tell?
Yeah, a Chinese national, especially one who's a member of the Communist Party and concurrently a Chinese official, should never have been president of Interpol. Meng Hongwei went missing at the end of September. We've learned that from Interpol that he's resigned. And he's clearly in detention in China. His wife is fearful for his life. And this is an indication of severe political stress inside the top of the Chinese political system, because China really wanted Meng to head Interpol, and for them to recall him, to put him under investigation for corruption, indicates that something is really wrong. It shows the extent to which Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, is willing to blacken China's reputation in the international community in order to obtain political control. They wouldn't do something like this except in the except where there's extraordinary political stress. So we've got to be very concerned about what's happening in Beijing right now. And it also shows, Frank, and going back to your original point, which I think is absolutely the critical one, is that our engagement policies were terribly misguided, thinking that a Chinese official should head a critical organization like Interpol. It just shows how bad our policies were. And so that's we should always keep that in mind.
Yeah, but and Gordon, I guess to that point, knowing what you do, is there any doubt in your mind that the reason the Chinese were so keen to have this Communist Party member with close ties to the government running Interpol, that they would be able to utilize it for their own nefarious purposes, presumably? And I wonder whether he wasn't doing enough of that, and that's why, you know, he fell from grace.
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons why they might have recalled him. You know, people are speculating, for instance, that that Xi Jinping was upset that Interpol was not more effective in getting the repatriation of Uyghur leaders. The Uyghurs are Muslims in China's northwest, and China right now is committing crimes against humanity by trying to eliminate ethnic and religion of the Uyghurs. There are people
on a massive scale, it should be noted.
On a massive scale, about 1 million Uyghurs, maybe 1.5 million, are in these political re-education centers, which look like Auschwitz, actually. The only thing that separates Auschwitz from the Chinese re-education centers is that, not that Uyghurs aren't dying in them, because they are. It's just that there is no attempt at mass extermination
in the crematoria
education centers.
Yeah,
What there are, though, is there's torture, there is death, and there is an attempt to eliminate a religion and an ethnic group in China. This is horrific.
Sadly, it's not the only religion that is being horrifically oppressed. As you know, the Falun Gong, they're harvesting the organs of people who are practitioners of that particular program. And of course, Christians are being brutally oppressed as well and persecuted. Gordon, let me just switch gears. I did want to ask you about what China is doing to us, a form of warfare. We often talk on the program about unrestricted warfare as kind of the model, according to these two PLA colonels who wrote a book on that topic back in 1999. But Gordon, we haven't talked, I don't think, you and I, about fentanyl and what the Chinese government is doing, or at least complicit in doing, that is killing many thousands, if not tens and hundreds of thousands of Americans through the use of this addictive and devastatingly deadly drug.
Yeah. Chinese gangs are manufacturing fentanyl in China, and they're distributing it through the United States. It's extremely addictive, results in the deaths of at least tens of thousands of Americans, maybe hundreds of thousands of Americans a year. And the Chinese government has to know what's going on because these gangs operate at a very high level. And what we're seeing right now is the Chinese government complicit in this. Because when you run essentially a semi-totalitarian state, a surveillance state, you have to know what's going on. And if you don't know what's going on, you don't want to know. But clearly, many Americans are dying, and we've got to hold the Chinese government responsible for this. And there's been a failure to do so across administrations.
This is terribly troubling because, of course, it feeds into the same deadly addiction as the opioid crisis, which is, to some extent, I guess, masking the Chinese contribution to this. But the nation is under assault. There's no question about it. It is a form of warfare against us, and China's up to its eyeballs in it. Let me ask you quickly, Gordon. There was a recent arrest of a Chinese intelligence officer in Brussels at the instigation of the United States. Apparently conducting espionage against U.S. aviation companies. I had occasion to see the other day a letter that was written a couple of months back by Lamar Smith and Randy Weber, two members of Congress on the Science and Technology Committee, to Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative, and it went through in considerable detail what is going on in terms of Chinese theft of technologies of not just American aviation companies or defense sector companies, for that matter, but all manner of others. Give us a sense of the magnitude of this espionage effort, if you can, and its consequences, both for us and for China.
The theft of U.S. intellectual property by China ranges in the hundreds of billions of dollars a year, and this is theft for commercial purposes, loss of U.S. intellectual property. You know, we spy on them, they spy on us. That's considered to be fair game. But what the United States doesn't do is we do not use the U.S. government to spy on Chinese commercial enterprises for the purpose of obtaining secrets that we then give to American competitors. And what China's doing, this theft is the biggest in the world, obviously. It's gone on for a very long time. A number of American presidents have allowed this to continue to their shame. This is both a Republican and a Democrat issue, and clearly it's got to stop. That's why President Trump has imposed these tariffs under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, and it's good for him. You know, a lot of people don't like tariffs. Nobody likes tariffs. But something's got to be done to stop this theft of intellectual property. And Republicans and Democrats have not done so. So good for President Trump. Good for the United States. Good for the world.
Gordon, I did want to just ask you very quickly, and this will not be sufficient time to do justice to the topic, but I gather that you've got a somewhat contrarian view about what the Chinese are up to with their Belt and Road Initiative. Many of us are concerned that this is a formula for imperial conquest, really, around the world, using a sort of a payday loan debt trap scheme as an enforcement mechanism. But you're not so worried about it, is that right?
Yeah. The Belt and Road Initiative is really to build infrastructure that the private sector wouldn't touch, so it's uneconomic. And although you've accurately described Beijing's intentions, there have been real problems with the Belt and Road right now. It is extremely controversial in China because many officials realize it's not working. Xi Jinping is pushing forward, and clearly this is going to be something we've got to be concerned about. But nonetheless, this is going to fail on its own weight.
Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate so much, as always, your time, your visits with us, and the extraordinary work you do at The Daily Beast and elsewhere. And I know that you'll come back to us again next week. I hope you'll do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.